Tony's materials and turn it over to Michelle to get started with our broadcast today. Michelle, feel free to begin.
Okay, great. Thank you, Jean. Yes, I wanted to just show you some resources that are available related to cleanup on mining sites. We have all of the archive webinars from this mining webinar series on this webpage, which you can see here, cluin.org/mining. But we also put other types of information there, so I wanted to make sure everyone was aware of that. And then getting into today, as Jean mentioned, this is part of a mining webinar series. Again, here's the direct link to where you can access previous webinars. I think we've been doing these since about 2012. So you can go through and see if there's any other topics you'd like to be interested in watching the archive. And then for today, we're very glad to be able to talk about the rotating cylinder treatment system at Elizabeth Mine. And we have Barbara Butler, who is a research environmental engineer with EPA's Office of Research and Development. She focuses on understanding the fate, transport, and ecotoxicology of inorganics in surface water, groundwater, and sediments in mining-influenced watersheds. And she looks at that information a number of different ways, so we're very excited to have Barb with us. And then we also have Ed Hathaway, who is the remedial project manager for this site, he has, on-site experience as well as Barb in being the project manager. And I would also like to mention that we have the pleasure of having Eric Hall is on the call also, and he's with Novus Group, who is one of the operators for the treatment system. So he's on with us today and will be available to answer any questions from that perspective. So keep that in mind as you're submitting questions. And as Jean mentioned, you can type questions in anytime throughout the presentation. And we encourage you to do that so that when we do get to the question period, we are ready to go and starting to ask questions. So thank you, everyone, for attending. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Barb and Ed for the presentation.
Thanks, Michelle. And thanks, everyone, for the opportunity to present today. Next slide, please. This is just our standard disclaimer that the views that we'll be presenting today are mine and Ed's and don't necessarily represent the views of the or policies of the EPA. Today, Ed will be providing you with a history of the Elizabeth Mine, and I'll cover water treatment for ferrous iron briefly, describe the RCTS system and a previous literature-reported comparison of it with conventional lime treatment, present the performance of the RCTS at the Elizabeth Mine for a 9-year period and the lessons that were learned. And Ed will close us out with some final remarks. Take it away, Ed.
Thank you, Barb. I appreciate the opportunity to participate in this webinar and hope the audience finds the information useful. Let me quickly present some of the Elizabeth Mine site history for context. So this first slide shows that the Elizabeth Mine is one of 6 locations in New England where Superfund actions have taken place at a mining site. It's located in East Central Vermont and near the intersections of Routes 91 and 89. Next slide, please. The Elizabeth Mine operated intermittently for about 150 years. The early period, until about 1882, was dominated by copper, iron sulfate production, the site responsible for 75% of the U.S. production at one time. The copper works generated about 30,000 tons of copper and 200,000 cubic yards of waste material. Copper production was limited during the period of 1830 to 1942, but that changed when Elizabeth Mine was a beneficiary of federal contracts to support World War II and the Korean War, which resulted in a 16-year period where about 45,000 tons of copper were produced in a flotation mill that generated about 3 million tons of tailing waste. Operation ceased in 1958, and Appalachian Sulfide sold off the property to the locals. Next slide, please. These are just a few photos for perspective. The upper left is the 1898 adit. It was one of the main haulage ways. Obviously, this was after the site closed. The bottom left does show the site during operation. And you can see the mill in the foreground and the tailing impoundment off in the distance. The lower right shows the tailing impoundment after closure, but you can clearly see the decant pond and the condition of the tailing impoundment. And the upper right shows the copper works waste piles in the foreground and the tailing off in the distance. Next slide, please. This is the photo of Elizabeth Mine when I started in 1999 when I started working on the site 22 years ago. The site has been abandoned since 1958, and no maintenance or inspections have been performed on the dam, the drainage structures, or the tailing impoundment in over 40 years. Next slide, please. The photos on this page show the erosion on the face of the tailing dam and the tailing impoundment. The top left was actually taken after we started work. You can see some construction roads there, but it gives you somewhat of a bigger picture perspective on the tailing dam. The others just show the various states of erosion ongoing at the site when we first started the work. Next slide, please. An investigation of Elizabeth Mine was initiated in 2000 and identified the following issues of concern. The tailing dam for tailing pond 1, the large tailing impoundment, was unstable. There were 5 miles of aquatic impacts, primarily due to copper, iron, zinc, and pH. Copper's brook itself had copper levels about 100,000 micrograms per liter. The pH in Copper's Brook was as low as 2, and the tailing impoundment leachate discharging from the impoundment had about 2 million micrograms per liter of iron. The sediment was found to be toxic to benthic organisms. We found lead in the soil at the Copper's factories, and the groundwater within the underground workings, the tunnels and shafts, and beneath the waste areas was considered unsuitable for human consumption due to various metals, mostly cadmium, copper, cobalt, iron, manganese. Next slide. The purple line on the map shows the extent of the aquatic impacts. Next slide. So based on the identified issues, EPA developed a cleanup strategy that focused on the following actions. First was to stabilize the tailing dam. Second was to target source control actions to minimize the generation of mine-influenced water from the waste piles and tailing impoundment by consolidating waste rock onto the impoundment, installing an infiltration barrier cover, diverting surface water and shallow groundwater. We actually modified the strategy midterm to add an interim active treatment system, which is discussion, the focus of this webinar. And our long-term goal was to have a passive treatment system to handle the residual leachate after the source control actions were successful. Next slide. Here we go. We've got a few slides here to show some of the cleanup work. The slide on the left shows working at the toe of the starter dam at the bottom of the tailing dam, installing some toe drains. The slide on the right just shows the long version of the toe drain system. Next slide. The slide on the left shows the construction of a 60,000 cubic yard compacted earth buttress to refortify the tailing dam. The slide on the right shows the tanned areas are the erosion control matting on the buttress that was installed, and the green areas are the slopes that were cut back to reduce erosion. Next slide. This is the before slide for the Copper's factories. They get the yellow and red piles that were all over the upper hillside. And the next slide is the after picture for the Copper's factories. We scraped all the material down. We brought it down onto the tailing impoundment. Next slide. So one of our key source control measures was, once again, to consolidate all the satellite waste areas, the 300,000 yards from the Copper's factories, 100,000 yards from other waste areas, 100,000 yards of excavated tailing that were both had slumped off the tailing dam, and also to achieve the final slope grades, onto the 45-acre tailing impoundment. We graded it to be solar friendly. It required about 150,000 cubic yards of soil to build the cover system and about 2 million square feet of geosynthetics. There's a sort of a cartoonized version on the left-hand side that shows the schematic for the closure, which has the tailing dam buttress, the layback of the slopes. The orange represents the waste rock placed on top of the tailing, and the green line is the cover system, which has the inset to the right of it that shows the different layers of the cover system as how it was constructed. And the photo down below shows the sort of the shiny black material is the geomembrane, the duller black material is the drain net, and then of course you see the brown cover soil being placed over the drain net. Next slide. This slide, even though it's a more recent slide showing the solar facility that was developed on top of the tailing impoundment, the blue outline is the extent of our shallow groundwater and surface water diversion channels that were installed. Next slide. So in 2007, after the toe drain and dam stabilization were completed, but before we had a chance to build the cover system and do the waste relocation, an extreme drought in the area caused an unusually low dilution of the leachate from the tailing impoundment on the west branch of the Wampanoag River, having, of course, this tremendous visual effect. So next slide. So as a result, we had about a 5-mile iron slick going down the Ompompanoosuck River, and you know, you've got the topo map that gives you the whole extent of the iron slick from the site on the left-hand side of the photo over to the Union Village Dam that's in the right side of the photo. And you can see the inset photo showing the iron staining in the river at those locations. So the next slide. So at that point, as a result of that condition, you know, we sort of adaptive management. You know, we had iron leachate creating acidity, smothering the benthic environment, creating a visual impact for several miles. We had a very vocal stakeholders, congressional, state representatives, really demanding that we do something. We hadn't yet implemented our source control actions, and we knew they actually would take time before they could even affect something like this. So we sought to implement a treatment technology that could effectively provide an effective interim solution until we could get to the point where we could use passive treatment. Next slide. In doing so, we knew we had several challenges. We had limited physical space. The picture on the right, it's a little hard to judge, but the topography drops off very steeply from the face of the tailing dam, dropping down to the river. It drops about several hundred feet from the toe of the dam to the river. It's Vermont. We have to deal with extended periods of very cold weather. We have high iron loads that we had to deal with, up to 800 pounds a day. If we were going to do something that involved open pond systems, we had to deal with significant precipitation events. But we did have electric power, which was available. In addition, we were trying to balance the fact that the state of Vermont doesn't have a lot of money to support operation and maintenance activities. So we turned to Office of Research and Development from EPA and our consultant to gain support to find a solution to this problem. Next slide. So I'm going to hand it off to Barb so she can introduce you to the overall construct and then right into the use of the RCTS at the Elizabeth Mine.
Thanks, Ed. Next slide, please. The treatment of ferrous iron typically involves adding oxygen to oxidize ferrous iron to ferric iron and also increasing the pH to above 3.5. Commonly, slaked lime or lime are used. And these first three equations on the slide show the oxidation of ferrous iron to ferric, the slaking of lime with water, and precipitation of ferric hydroxide using the slaked lime. In the system, ferrous hydroxide will also precipitate with lime and become oxidized to ferric hydroxide when it's oxygenated. Next slide, please. The abiotic oxidation rate of ferrous iron is shown by this equation, second bullet. It has a first-order dependence on the concentrations of ferrous iron and on oxygen, meaning that a doubling of either the ferrous concentration or the oxygen concentration will double the rate of oxidation. There's a second-order dependence on the hydroxide concentration, and with pH being a log unit, an increase of one pH unit is a tenfold increase in hydroxide concentration. So this would increase the rate of the reaction by 100 times, 10 raised to the power of 2, and the plot on the right shows the half-life of ferrous iron as a function of pH. You can see with the blue line that's drawn that at a pH of 7, oxidation takes only minutes. Next slide, please. For active treatment systems, there's a general preference to treat iron with lime over sodium hydroxide because it creates a denser sludge and has a higher neutralization capacity. Sodium hydroxide requires more careful storage as a caustic liquid, and it has the potential to freeze. Lime also allows a slower change in pH with each incremental dose, and depending on the site, there may be concerns with discharging large quantities of sodium. Next slide, please. Now I'll be talking about the comparison of RCTS and the RCTS in general. Next slide. The RCTS was designed by Water Technologies Incorporated to be more compact and mobilizable. It replaces conventional agitators, compressors, diffusers, and reaction tanks that are used in conventional lime treatment plants with a perforated cylinder that rotates through a trough containing a lime slurry and water to be treated. Next slide. In the RCTS, the water adheres to the inner and outer surfaces of the cylinder as it rotates to facilitate oxygen exchange. Agitation by impact of the perforations with the water enhances the lime mixing and dissolution, as well as oxygen transfer to the water. Next slide, please. In 2009, Tsukamoto and Weems presented data from a direct comparison of a conventional lime treatment plant with the RCTS that was conducted at the Leviathan mine in California. The results showed that the RCTS had a comparably lower lime consumption rate, a higher dissolved oxygen concentration in the effluent, a shorter residence time was required, and also less energy was consumed. Next slide, please. Next slide. The RCTS system was chosen at the Elizabeth mine because it has a relatively small footprint and it could handle the very high iron loads. It would have been difficult and expensive to keep the water from freezing both before and after treatment, and the building would have required insulation and heating in the very cold climate, so the system was operated only during the months of April through November. It was designed to handle an average flow of 30 gallons per minute and a maximum flow of 40 gallons per minute, as well as to attain an effluent iron concentration maximum of 50 milligrams per liter with an average influent concentration of 900 milligrams per liter. The system was anticipated to have an operational life of 5 years, but it operated for 10. Next slide, please. This picture shows an aerial view of the site's treatment components. Following the red arrows, the water is collected from the TP1 drains, goes to the RCTS in the white building, and the treated water goes to the sedimentation basin. Next slide, please. The flow into the system from the leachate collection manifold was controlled by floats in the pump station, and the pumps operated at a higher rate than the leachate flow rate from the tailings, and a wet well level needed to be kept. This resulted in the typical sump operation being only 9 to 10 hours a day. Next slide, please. From the wet well, the leachate was pumped into a neutralization mixing tank, shown here at the bottom right. Some of the leachate went through a funnel and was mixed with quicklime from the silo in a grinder pump. The funnel and the grinder are shown in the image on the top right. The slurry from the grinder was recirculated back into the neutralization and mixing tank, and the reason this was done was to increase the residence time for neutralization of the water. One of the checks to see whether the neutralization is occurring properly is to observe the color of the water in the tank, which, although it's hard to tell in this photo, it's a dark bluish green, and that's from the formation of small particles of ferrous hydroxide. Next slide, please. From the neutralization tank, water flowed by gravity to the RCTS unit, where it was aerated as a thin layer of water around the inside of the rotating cylinders. The image on the bottom left shows the trough that held two of the rotating cylinders, and the picture on the top right, is one of the cylinders. The image on the bottom right shows the location of the neutralization tank, the funnel and grinder, both of those back at the distance, and the electrical panels and connections over on the side. These images provide a sense of the small size of the enclosure that was needed for the system. Next slide, please. Once aerated and neutralized, the water was gravity fed from the RCTS to the sedimentation basin. A visual check on the oxidation of the water in the RCTS is the brown color that's at the end here at the bottom of the photo on the left. And this indicates the presence of small particles of ferric oxide. Hydroxide. Next slide, please. Some key operation and maintenance needs are to operate, obviously, in accordance with manufacturer's instructions, to maintain accurate records of data from operations, process operation monitoring using field analytical methods, removing precipitates from component parts, system parts when necessary, troubleshooting and repairing and replacing any faulty equipment, and seasonal operation at this site required commissioning and decommissioning every year. Next slide, please. Data included in this case study were from 2009 to 2017 and included at least one sample from each month of operation. The schematic on the right shows the performance monitoring locations in yellow circles. The field kit performance data used were total iron, which includes ferrous and ferric iron species, and ferrous iron. The last bullet on the slide has an error where it should read that both total and ferrous iron measurements were conducted on both filtered and unfiltered samples. Samples were unfiltered at ITO1, which is the influent to the neutralization tank, and at ITO5, which is effluent from the sedimentation basin. And they were filtered at ITO3, which is effluent from the RCTS. pH from all three of these locations also was examined in the case study. Next slide, please. This plot shows load of iron in the brown circles on the primary y-axis and flow in blue squares on the secondary y-axis, both as a function of time over 2005 to 2018. The yearly average iron concentrations are marked by yellow triangles, and the yellow diamonds mark the yearly average flows. The main thing to note in this graph is that after each activity that Ed spoke about earlier was completed, the average yearly flows and the loads decreased, and they continued to decrease over time after the cover was completed in 2012. Next slide, please. This plot shows the concentrations of total iron on the y-axis versus time with the unfiltered influent to the RCTS, shown as blue circles, and the unfiltered effluent from the sedimentation basin, shown as light blue asterisk. I always get keyed up on that word, asterisks. The filtered total iron in the effluent from the RCTS is shown by the green diamonds. The flow is shown on the secondary y-axis with solid black lines. Comparing the results between the sampling locations shows that the concentrations decreased with the treatment. You can also see that the concentrations in the influent water to be treated also decreased with time. Concentration from the sediment basin, the light blue stars, were generally near to or less than 1 mg/L. 1 mg/L is important because that's the water quality criterion for iron in Vermont. Next slide, please. This plot is laid out the same as the previous one, and it shows the decreases in concentrations of unfiltered ferrous iron over time for the influent and sedimentation basin samples, and the filtered ferrous concentrations from the RCTS. Concentrations from the sedimentation basin are generally less than 1, with only a few exceptions. Next slide, please. This plot shows pH over time for the same locations. Combined fields influence pH, the blue circles, remain mostly within the range of about 5.5 to 6.8 over the 9 years of data analyzed. There is more variability in the pH in both the RCTS effluent, the green diamonds, and the sedimentation basin effluent, the light blue stars, with maximum pH values occurring in the RCTS effluent. Based on some field data from 2015, the optimal pH range for the effluent from the neutralization tank and the RCTS was 8.5 to 11, and from 8.5 to 9.5 for the sedimentation basin effluent. Although operational experience over the 10 years of the system also demonstrated that operating the RCTS at pH less than 8 led to high amounts of ferrous iron in the sedimentation basin effluent, and operation above pH 9.5 led to an increase in gypsum formation and scaling of the rotating cylinder. In this figure shows that the pH of the RCTS effluent in the green is generally exceeds 9.5. Next slide, please. These two plots show the percentage removal between the influent to the RCTS and the effluent from the sedimentation basin for unfiltered ferrous iron over time on the left, and unfiltered total iron over time on the right, as well as the monthly averages and the variability for the sedimentation basin pH on the secondary y-axis. The lowest removal efficiency was 98% for unfiltered samples of total iron. Next slide, please. These three graphs show concentrations from laboratory data that were collected on some dates for total recoverable iron as solid orange triangles, and filterable iron as black squares on the y-axis, and then the dates that they were sampled on the x-axis. The figure on the left is the influent to the neutralization mixing tank and shows a decreasing trend in concentrations over time, most evident starting with the 2013 samples, which was after the cover system had been completed. The concentration of total recoverable iron from the RCTS is in the middle graph, and that's essentially the same as it is for the combined influent, but filtered iron concentration is much lower in the RCTS effluent compared to the plot on the left, In fact, only the October 2009 sample was identified as being above the laboratory's detection limit. So this suggests that the RCTS effectively removed dissolved ferrous iron. The graph on the right shows the total recoverable iron is decreased to less than 6 milligrams per liter from more than 200 milligrams per liter that was shown in the middle graph. And filtered iron was generally less than 0.2 milligrams per liter, which was the detection limit. This indicates effective settling of precipitated iron hydroxides. Next slide, please. This plot shows percentage removal of total recoverable iron and filtered iron from lab results on the y-axis and sampling date on the x-axis. The percentage of total recoverable iron removed between the RCTS effluent and the treatment system effluent shown by the blue circles was less than 10%. This result would be expected because the neutralization and aeration steps change the oxidation state of the iron and its solubility, and it's expected that most of the settling of precipitates will occur in the sedimentation basin, as the water velocity from the RCTS to the basin should keep those precipitates that are formed in suspension. The small amount that's removed by the RCTS indicates coating of the neutralization mixing tank or of the rotating cylinder, both of which did occur over time and was periodically cleaned off along with gypsum scale. Similar to the field data, the laboratory data also showed high removal percentages for both total recoverable and filtered iron, with the lowest removal of 97% for total recoverable iron and 98% for filterable iron. Next slide, please. Dissolved oxygen in the TP1 drain varied widely over 2007 to 2010. It wasn't routinely monitored with the system, but data collected in 2009 indicated that the average dissolved oxygen in the RCTS influent was 4.3, and the average effluent from the RCTS was 6.4, which indicates the RCTS added about an average of 2 milligrams per liter of dissolved oxygen to the water. Next slide, please. These two pictures show the comparison of before treatment on the left, a slide or a picture that you saw a little earlier, and after the treatment system startup on the right, which shows a dramatic difference in the Ompompanoosuc River. Next slide. Now I'll be presenting some lessons learned. Next slide. Calcium from lime dissolution will react with sulfate to form gypsum when sulfate concentration is greater than about 1.5 to 2 grams per liter. Total recoverable sulfate concentration in the TP1 leachate ranged from about 1.5 to 4.2 grams per liter with an average of 3.2. The image on the top right shows a piece of the scale, and the image on the bottom right shows one clean cylinder and one cylinder still coated with gypsum and iron precipitates. Scaling and plugging affected nearly all components of the system. And some of the things that happened, the system experienced clogged pipes and outlets, cracked seams in the drums, failed bearings from scale buildup, which caused an unbalanced rotation, and blocking of sedimentation basin effluent pipe. In one instance, the reaction of lime with water is exothermic, and in one instance, a clogged pipe actually melted from the lime. Next slide, please. Some other things learned are, to make life a little easier, plumbing and equipment should be as accessible as possible for maintenance tasks. The design should consider potential future upgrades, and pumps should be configured to allow for use of universal motors. Many factors need to be considered to optimize both the efficiency and the cost, such as identifying and understanding required specifications for components in contact with the lime, and identifying ways to minimize complications of gypsum formation when there's high concentrations of sulfate. Next slide, please. It's also important to closely monitor pH to assure sufficient neutralization followed by effective aeration with minimal scaling. As I mentioned earlier, operational experience showed the optimum pH for treating water at this site from the RCTS was between 8 and 9.5. Monitoring ferrous iron allows assessment of oxidizing performance, but monitoring of DO may also be helpful in assuring there is a sufficient oxidation occurring in the RCTS to minimize any reliance on the sedimentation basin for additional oxidation. Next slide, please. And sludge storage and disposal can be a challenge. Some of the things to consider are whether there's a potential for anyone to trespass since the consistency of the sludge doesn't support someone walking on it, and whether there are any hazardous components in the sludge that would require off-site disposal, as well as whether there's sufficient land to allow for on-site disposal if it's non-hazardous. And lastly, sufficient funds should be available to allow replacement of components to avoid the loss of treatment capability. Although the system lasted twice as long as it was designed to, the RCTS drums and neutralization tank were approaching the end of their useful lives. And now I'll pass it back to Ed for some final remarks.
Yes, thank you, Barb. Next slide. So in summary, the temporary treatment system provided effective treatment for 10 years. We routinely met our 1 part per million, milligram per liter, iron effluent standard. Over that entire time, we treated almost 51 million gallons of leachate, and we were able to effectively help the transition where the source control could affect both the flow and the concentration of the leachate, so that we went from a pitch situation where we started with 800 pounds a day of iron being discharged, and at the end of its useful life, we were down to 24 pounds a day of iron discharge. Next slide. So in the big picture, you know, we had stabilized the dam. We have seen iron and copper concentration loads reduced to Copper's Brook and the West Branch. We've seen a 99% reduction in copper concentrations as a result of the source control actions. We've seen a 95% reduction in the iron concentration as a result of the source control actions. We've seen a 4 pH shift in the surface water from those actions, and we continue to see a decline in the leachate flow levels. Next slide. And, you know, just as a plug for the benefit of both the treatment system and the source control actions, the West Branch of the Ompompanoosuc River was on the federal and state impaired waters list. And in 2014, it was actually officially removed from the impaired waters list, and it had likely been an impaired water since the early 1800s and documented to be impaired since monitoring began in the 1960s. Next slide. And so the RCTS really helped us walk that transition from the source control action to get to where we really wanted to be, which was a passive treatment system that we were able to install in 2019 and is now fully operational. And that will be the subject of a discussion on another day. So I appreciate the opportunity to present. And I believe, Michelle, we're opening for questions now.
Yes, so we received a number of questions coming in as you both were speaking, and I want to encourage people to continue to type in any questions as we're going through them now. Someone had asked about you mentioning that the system operated only from April to November. So how were you managing leachate during the rest of the year in the winter months?
Well, candidly, you know, that was the compromise we had to make from a, both an economic perspective. Well, we didn't want to have to build a formal building facility and have everything heated and freeze protected. And what we also found, for reasons I can't personally explain, that the iron impacts dropped off dramatically as the temperature dropped. So we didn't see the iron plume downstream during the winter. It was not visual, but it came back every spring, and it stayed through the summer. So we sort of, because this was an interim treatment, it wasn't our final action. It wasn't attempt. It wasn't really designed to be our final achievement of cleanup standards. We struck that compromise, which allowed us to build a more cost-effective system and operate under conditions, you know, from both an accessibility and functionality perspective to get it to work. So it's that's the reason.
Okay, thank you. I think, Barb, you might have mentioned this, but I'm going to ask you just in case there's any clarification need, because this question came up a couple times. Around, I guess, slide 40, it shows that the effluent concentrations were increasing between 2016 and 2017. So there were a couple questions that came in about it, and I think you tried to explain it as it seemed to coincide with your effort not to overlime, but were there any other operational factors that changed during that time period? or any other explanations?
Yeah, good question. So we really don't know the reason why that jump was observed with, you know, there, one of the things that did change in that period of time was there was a change in the operator at the site. And so the methods that are used, they're field methods, and sometimes, you know, it could be interpretation, it could be the methodology that was, you know, followed. We don't know the actual answer to that question. And we actually did call that out in the report too as being something that we don't know exactly what caused that. We have some hypotheses, but no firm answer.
Yeah, and to add to that, I think we were comfortable in that the effluent from the set basin concentrations actually consistently remained within our target levels. But you're right, we did have a change in operators. The flow was dropping dramatically at that time, and we were actually starting to see color changes in the neutralization tank, indicating that the low flow might have been causing more agitation and oxidation from the pump station up into the neutralization tank. But we don't have a good explanation for it.
Ed, this is Eric. Although I wasn't involved with the operation during that time period, 2016 and 2017, looking at the data, I think it just may be that they didn't filter the sample prior to it going to the said basin like we were doing prior to simulate settling is what I think the difference is when you see the higher total iron concentrations. I don't have that graph in front of me, but I believe that's the difference. But again, I wasn't involved with the operation at that point.
Yes, and I let me just pause for a second to say I apologize for not properly introducing Eric Hall with Nobis Group. Is one of the engineers that has supported EPA at this project for over 10 years. He was part of the group that identified the use of the RCTS system and constructed it, and was a major component of the operation and assessment of it over the 10-year period. So just as a matter of introduction.
Great, thank you all. Our next question is there any effluent limitations in Vermont for discharge to surface water at high pHs? I guess the questioner noticed there were many effluent data points where the pH was greater than 10 and maybe even up to 11.
Vermont, once again, is from a long-term, quote, ARAR perspective. They have a plus or minus, so to speak, on the amount of pH shift you can have. The West Branch itself is actually a fairly alkaline system that has a pH of usually around 8. But they do have a pH bracket. I don't have it off the top of my head. Had we maintained this system as a long-term solution, then we may have had to consider that for Coppers Brook. Coppers Brook is a smaller water body. It flows, I mean, the West Branch, you're talking about tens to hundreds to even thousands of CFS at times. The dilution is tremendous. It gets quickly assimilated. Coppers Brook is your typical high gradient mountain stream. There are times when the flow is very low. As a matter of fact, there are times, as in 2007, when the flow was almost entirely the leachate. And so from a long-term perspective, that is something that we would have had to have addressed. Once again, the stakeholders were all accepting of the fact that in the short term, even though it turned out to be 10 years, that removing the iron and achieving the water quality standards for the chemical constituents was a higher priority, and that we would just continue to monitor. And I want to reinforce, we did not see any pH issues in the West Branch. The little quarter mile section of Coppers Brook, the pH, it mitigated fairly quickly, but I don't have the data for that. But that, if we had made that a permanent system, we would have had to address that.
Okay. And I guess related to the pH, there's been a couple questions coming in wondering if you had any scale observed downstream. There's any scaling in the stream.
Well, I think as many of you may realize, the Coppers Brook itself was essentially had a ferrocrete base. So after, you know, 150 years of mining and discharge, I'm not sure we would have been able to differentiate very well. We did not see, as a matter of fact, the West Branch, once again, the main receiving surface water body, the rocks and the bed, as we showed in that picture, looked very well. And we had complete benthic recovery and the inspections by the Vermont Water Quality Monitoring Group at the Vermont DEC didn't report any issues there. So, we tended to meet our target of 1 milligram per liter. As I said, if you're trying to differentiate, it's kind of hard when you go down there and you chip into the sediment and you see 6-8 inches of just ferricrete deposit.
Okay, that makes sense. Someone wants to know if you can explain again what's happening in the funnel operation. Is that for dosing of lime as ground calcium oxide, and how is it transferred to the drum?
Ed, you want me to take that one?
Do that one? Go ahead.
Sure. So I don't have the slide up in front of me, but the water came up from the wet well, and as that water came up from the wet well, it was split into the neutralization tank and also to the funnel. The lime came over and was fed into the funnel off the silo, and in order, we needed water to circulate that lime down to the grinder pump. And so that's what the purpose of the funnel was. And then the water would go in the funnel down to the grinder pump, which would grind up the lime, and then it would feed over to the neutralization tank. And just for additional water, we would feed water back from the neutralization tank to help to move the lime around.
And if it wasn't obvious, we had a dry lime feed, so that's the waterless for transport of the lime.
Okay, great. We got a couple questions. People are wondering if you analyzed or were there any other heavy metals or other contaminants or constituents in the effluent, and if so, how does this treatment affect those levels being discharged?
We looked at that, and we were very fortunate that the leachate discharge from the tailing impoundment is almost exclusively iron and sulfate. We have hundreds of samples of the tow drain system. And we sampled the effluent. We would do a full metals analysis. We even analyzed the sludge on occasion. And this may be different for different sites and different circumstances. And had we used this treatment technology for the upper Copperas Works or some of the more exposed waste rock piles, we would have clearly been wrestling with levels of copper, zinc, cobalt, maybe even cadmium. But the discharge from the tailing impoundment, and we've seen that even in the monitoring wells that we've sampled from the tailing impoundment just were essentially almost exclusively iron and sulfate.
Okay, great. We had another question about the system. What caused the blockage of the sedimentation pond effluent pipe? Was it ferric hydroxide solids, and how was it solved?
Well, we had several blockages, and Eric can add probably better detail, but we had an initial blockage of the lime feed, the lime itself solidified and created a backup that created the melting. And then that darn gypsum, pretty much any time we had a pipe, we accreted quite a bit of gypsum in it, and at one point Eric probably had to clean that pipe out or unclog it.
Yeah. And initially, where it would come down from the funnel, initially everything was hard piped in the whole system. We thought that would be better, but it turns out that it created more maintenance. So if you were to rebuild the system, and we did this as we optimized along the time, we found out that having flexible hoses made things so much easier between the whole system. So whether it was the funnel to the neutralization tank, anywhere we could, we put flexible hoses. We did have a couple of blockages in the said basin, initially it had an under drain where you saw that long stick that was taking out the sludge in the picture. That was the first time we drained the tank and got rid of the sludge. Over time, the gypsum unfortunately plugged that under drain. So the way around it was we had to build a weir on the side of the sedimentation basin so that when it got up to the elevation, it would just flow over and not go out the pipe was our way to solve that problem.
Okay, thank you. Let's see. Let's ask this other question here we got in about the piping. Did you have a protocol for unclogging, or did you replace pipes? What was the procedure for that?
Well, I think that there was one was, as Eric pointed, when we had a consistent problem, we just tried to solve the problem by either changing the type of piping or, in the case of the effluent discharge, we actually eliminated the piping and went with a wear system. Besides that, I'll let Eric hang on as they spent a lot of time cleaning both the drums and different pipes at times.
Yeah, as Ed mentioned, and as I said before, we figured out that flexible hosing was the key, and then to do preventative maintenance. So we would try to change out our hoses about every 2 weeks. And as we would change them out, we would clean them with acid and just banging out any of the gypsum that would accumulate on our hoses. About once a week to every 2 weeks, we would flush our neutralization tank. We had a pipe where we were able to just discharge that directly to the sed basin, and that would get out any sludge that was in that tank. And then as it was optimized, I won't talk about the whole beginning, but we were able to put a crane system inside the building that could take off the cover. And we were able to probably towards the end when it was optimized about twice a year take the cover off, bang out the holes in the RCTS as you saw in that one picture where one was scaled over and one was white. That was in the middle of a cleaning process. And the other thing we did was we added wash ports on the side of the RCTS to be able to flush out any lime buildup that we were getting in the RCTS and gypsum.
Okay, thank you. Can you share any information about the cost of the system, what it costs to install it, and the annual operation and maintenance?
Yeah, sort of. You know, all installations are site-specific, and so the question of the cost of the actual treatment system versus all the earthwork that was done to make room for the sed basin and install it, I don't have those numbers handy. I can tell you that, you know, it was costing us about between $200,000 and $250,000 a year to operate the system. And the total installation costs, I think it might have approached $1 million, but I don't know that it's been a while since I looked at those numbers. But we had to do a fair amount of earthwork, as we had showed in that one photo. There wasn't a lot of good topography available, and just to get the sediment basin in, you know, we had to dig that out and get that all set up.
Okay. Then we had a question about the sludge. Is any of it hazardous to wildlife, and is there any practical way that to solidify the upper layers of it or put a cover on the sludge?
So the sludge has been another one of our challenges. We had the advantage for the first several years to be able to put it on top of the tailing impoundment and bury it under the cover system. And then we gained another advantage that by that, you know, we experienced such a rapid drop in load after the cover system that we actually accumulated it in the basin for the final 5+ years. And then when we were done, we actually mixed it with cement and we consolidated at one end of the basin and we put a soil cover over it. So we wanted to make sure it had a consistency that wouldn't be a hazard from basically sinking in it. And then we wanted to cover it. One of our passive treatment consultants who works in Pennsylvania specializes in looking at the reuse of iron sludges for paint pigments and others, but unfortunately the site location was such that even though it's in the, you know, we're in the east, it's still far enough from anywhere that who would want to use it to make the cost not practical. And as I said, when we analyzed the sludge, it's pretty much, you know, iron and carbonate, but we couldn't find anyone. If it gets more use, there may be some opportunities for it. If you have a similar situation where we really didn't have any hazardous constituents. But that's a real shift. Once again, if we were going to operate this in perpetuity, we were then going to have a mechanism to probably pull it out, dry it out, form a dry cake or something, and find a landfill or someplace else where we can dispose it and get rid of it just from a bulk perspective. That is one of the challenges.
Michelle, can I add something to the question previous about cost?
Yeah, please do.
Yeah. For those that are interested in that, there is a little bit about cost in the EPA report, and I just pulled it up for a generalized statement. For treating 1 gallon of water, it was about 7 cents per gallon, and that was based on some numbers that are averages, but that information is in the report.
Okay, great. Thanks, Barb. Yeah, and I think we have a link to that report in the related URLs that are associated with this webinar. So if you go to that part of the Adobe Connect screen here, you'll be able to find that pretty easily. Thank you. I guess we have time for one last question I see here. We know this is an interim treatment system put in at the site, and I guess there's just some interest if there's any information or details you can share about the new system, if you will, that is being used at Elizabeth Mine.
Yeah, I'll start, and Barb, if you want to add on to that, feel free. So, as I mentioned in one of the slides, the long-term goal from the beginning was passive treatment. But we just never had, we did not have the load that really allowed it to be practical from the space perspective. So once the load's dropped enough, we work with our consultants, we work with Barb and other experts. Bob Hedden provided a lot of good input, and we developed a passive treatment system that collects the drain system that used to go to the RCTS. We now have it plumbed into an oxic limestone drain, and then from there it goes into a settling pond, and then a polishing wetland, and then it goes into a vertical flow pond with a compost top and a limestone base, and it comes out that and goes into another wetland, and then it drops into the stream, and it is effectively removing the iron. And we have been monitoring that carefully, and as Barb alluded to, we hope to do a webinar on that in the future. There are some challenges that we certainly encountered with both the ALD and other factors, but it's working well, and that goes year round. So we've been actually monitoring it almost monthly for the past couple of years, and so far so good. And I think one of our big theme pictures is that the combination of aggressive source control with the opportunity to handle the problem as an interim measure without having to build a permanent expensive system, and then being able to transition to a much more cost-effective passive system, at least in this case, worked well for us, and we're happy with the outcome.
Did you want to add anything, Barb?
No. Thank you. I think that was a great explanation, and I look forward to presenting data on the passive treatment system in a future webinar.
Great. Great. I did see one last question come in that I'll ask quickly. What flows are you treating through the passive system?
Right now we're looking at around 6 to 9 gallons a minute. And the iron concentration is an average of about 150 milligrams per liter.
Okay, great. Thank you. Well, we did get to all of our questions, and I want to thank all the participants. These are very engaging and good questions, and I'm glad for your participation with this part of the webinar. And I'll let Barb and Ed and Eric, all know we're getting a lot of thank yous from the participants in our chat box now. They really appreciated your presentation. So thank you for taking the time, and we look forward to having you talk about this site again in the future. So thank you. Really appreciate it.
No, thank you.
Yep, thank you.
Great. At this point, Jean, I'm going to turn it over to you to wrap up our session for us.
All right. Thanks so very much, Michelle. All right. With that, I'll go ahead and walk through just a few final reminders as we close things out today. I do encourage those of you who are interested in learning more about online training opportunities, technical publications, and technologies to either characterize or clean up our sites, feel free to visit us at cluin.org or sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct. If you are looking for copies of the presentation materials, those have already been posted to download from the seminar homepage. As I highlighted at the start of our session today, if you visit that homepage, there are tabs that will allow you to access information about our speakers, their slides, and related resources, including that EPA report, which was highlighted at the end of our session today. So we have all of that information bookmarked on the seminar homepage. I'll also ask each of you to fill out our brief online feedback form to let us know what you thought of our delivery today, both in the content that was covered along with the technology that we used to host it. Please know I do read each and every one of those submissions, and they help us to continue to offer technical presentations like this through the Cleanup Information Network. I'm often asked if we issue CEUs or PDHs for our sessions. While we don't provide those types of credit hours, we can give you a participation certificate after you fill out the feedback form. Please note there is a box at the bottom of that form that you must check, and along with including a valid email address. And as soon as you submit feedback and you've checked that box on the form and you send it in, you'll immediately have access to a participation certificate that looks something like this one, which will have information about the session, including its date, time, and length. You'll also be able to download, as I said, the presentation materials, and oftentimes our attendees are able to earn credit for sitting in on our webinars with participation certificates and the materials and their registration emails. If you happen to share your connection with others, so if there were people connecting with you, each person can fill out that online feedback form to get their own certificate, even if they didn't register for the live session. And if you happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying today's recorded session, as I noted at the start, it was recorded, you'll automatically get an email with a link to play back the archive. It usually takes us about 1 week or so to produce that, and you're welcome to share that with others that you think will find this valuable. But if you're watching the recorded version, you can still follow the links over to that seminar feedback form. Again, they're available to you in the middle right under related URLs. I've also pasted them directly into that Q&A pod as well. So with that, I want to echo everybody's thanks to our presenters and organizers who took time out of their days to share their expertise and help host this session, as well as all of the support staff who were on in the background. And with that, we'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast.